Good morning, congregation. We are in John. Actually, we're going to start in John chapter 11 this morning, where we left off last Sunday with Jesus commanding and Lazarus emerging from the tomb without the slightest scent of death upon him. The only thing that needed to be changed about Lazarus when he came out from the tomb was what? His clothes, that's right. He was in a burial shroud, and he needed to put on some street clothes. There wasn't the slightest scent of death upon him. But as we continue through John's gospel here and the story of Jesus, the scent of death gets stronger and stronger as he approaches to his cross, not on Lazarus, but on Jesus. And in John chapter 11, beginning in verse 45, we're going to see that this incredible sign that Jesus performed got some decidedly mixed reviews from those who observed it. Verse 45 of John 11. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary, she seems to have been the popular one, I guess, among the three, and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish? He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not die for that nation only, but also for the scattered children of God to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all?" But the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it, so that they might arrest him. So many believed in Jesus after he raised Lazarus from the dead. But the priests who ran the temple in Jerusalem and the Pharisees who served as experts in the law, together they comprised the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, which was sort of the Supreme Court of Judaism in that day. They worried that the exploding popularity of Jesus would cause them nothing but pain and trouble, that it would foment revolt among all the pilgrims, particularly who were coming to Jerusalem for the Passover, and that this would get Rome involved in a way they didn't want. Now, Pilate had a small contingent of Roman soldiers in Jerusalem at this time. In fact, they had a fortress that overlooked the whole temple area where they could kind of keep an eye on what was going on there to make sure that Jewish nationalism didn't get out of hand. But even more threatening, not far to the north in Syria, a place that's in the news today, the Romans had a great deal of military power that could come down on Jerusalem in a minute if they felt that there were some would-be messiahs that were getting the populace out of hand, and they could crush it pretty quickly if they stepped in. And so the Sanhedrin is looking out for itself. They're worried that they're going to lose their place of power, their place of privilege, and to be honest about it, they're worried that they're going to lose the monetary profit that they get from all the pilgrims that come into the temple year after year for these major events in the holy city. And so the love of money proves to be the root of all kinds of evil as the gospel unfolds here in John 11 and John 12. So Caiaphas, who's the chief priest, and John says he's the chief priest that year. He was actually the chief priest for a lot of years, but John is highlighting that year because that's the year that Jesus goes to his cross. But Caiaphas proposes that if they hand Jesus over to the Romans, then they, the Sanhedrin, can survive. They'll prove themselves to be friends of Caesar. Now, when you move on through the Gospel of John and you get to the place where Jesus is tried by Pilate, you can see that Pilate sees through this scheme, this ruse. He sees that their motives are selfish and nationalistic, and being the honorary guy he doesn't want to go along with them either, but he eventually orders Jesus to be crucified. But what John's gospel tells us is that Caiaphas is speaking here more truth than he knows, because he's the high priest. And going back to the time of Aaron, when the high priests were given the Urim and Thummim, those precious stones that enable them to discern God's will, the high priests were viewed as having oracular powers, the power to speak for God. In this case, he does so probably unintentionally. But God can turn to good even what corrupt human beings intend for evil. And there is a tremendous comfort in that. No one of us has to get everything right for God to accomplish his purposes. And in fact, God can accomplish his purposes even when evil people intend things that are unjust, as Caiaphas does here. In fact, the death of Jesus is going to accomplish the exact opposite of what Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin intend. They're hoping that if they somehow can kill Jesus, it will put a damper on its popularity. But as our text unfolds today, it actually becomes the basis, his death, his cross does, for forming a much larger movement of people, not only in that generation, but now for over 2,000 years down into the present. The death of Jesus is what draws people to Jesus in a very surprising way. And it isn't just Judeans who will come to trust in Jesus, as was happening then, but people from every place and across the centuries that are drawn to his death and to his cross. But the time for that hasn't quite come yet. It's not yet time for Jesus to die. And so he and his disciples keep a low profile in our text. They move to this little area called Ephraim, about 15 miles from the city, because it's still about a week away before Passover comes, when Jesus is going to set things in motion. And when he does show up, it's going to be the third Passover highlighted in this gospel. The public ministry of Jesus takes place over about a period of 2 or 3 years. And there are 2 or 3 Passovers recorded in this gospel, and the last one is the one that will lead to his death. So everyone in the city of Jerusalem at this time, as the pilgrims are coming in, thousands and thousands of people are coming into the city of Jerusalem for this event. They're all keeping an eye out for Jesus. Some of them are keeping a friendly eye out for him, hoping that he'll start a movement. Others are keeping out an unfriendly eye for him, hoping to suppress him in some way. And the place that he first shows up, though, is just a little ways out of Jerusalem, about 2 miles out, in the little town of Bethany, where he had raised Lazarus from the dead. And all of his three close friends are there, Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Lazarus is reclining with Jesus at a dinner, typical of him. Martha is involved in serving the dinner, typical of her. And Mary throws herself with abandon at Jesus' feet, which is typical of her. So read with me beginning in chapter 12, if you would. Verse 1, 6 days before the Passover. So it's going to be Sabbath. Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead, just in case you'd forgotten. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, typical of her, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it out on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, a keeper of the money bag. He used it to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there. Remember, they were looking for him. And they came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. Now this time, Mary has a large bottle of expensive ointment that she's going to pour out. And if there were any folks there that had fragrance allergies, they were in big trouble, because we're told that the smell of it filled the whole room. Can you just imagine if I had some really cool aftershave on and all of a sudden people in the back were getting these headaches and everything from it? That's what it was like, okay? Mary was treating this precious oil as casually as if it were a basin of water. And she's treating her hair, which Jewish women would characteristically keep bound up as a symbol of modesty. She's using her hair, she's letting it down as a towel to wipe the feet of Jesus. And at this, one of the disciples' heads almost splits in two, not because of the fragrance, but because of what Mary has done. Now, it may be that Judas, poor guy that he is, has a point about the poor. Bethany means house of the poor, as I mentioned last week. And Judas evidently views himself as among the poor. Poor Judas, because he has a way of helping himself to the benevolent fund. He sounds like the thief that Jesus described in John chapter 10, the thief who comes to steal and to kill and to destroy. But Jesus comes to bring abundant life, doesn't he? Jesus said about the thief that he won't enter through the gate of the sheepfold, and that will prove true of Judas. But if you read the next chapter, 13, we won't get there this morning, I'll just allude to it. You can't help but see that Mary has some insight too. Because when Jesus finally gets around to celebrating the Passover in the upper room, Jesus is going to do something very similar to what Mary does here. He isn't going to take expensive ointment, just a basin of ordinary water. He isn't going to use his hair, it probably wasn't long enough. But he is going to take a towel and wipe the feet of every disciple in that room. And included among those who's going to get his feet washed is Judas. It's almost like Mary is following Jesus and his example and his command even before Jesus gives the example and the command, isn't it? In that same scene, Jesus gives Judas a piece of bread and sends him away. And again, everyone just figures that Judas has gone out with the checkbook to buy some groceries or to give money to the poor. Turns out, of course, that Judas is making sure, again, that poor Judas gets his payday when he goes out from the upper room. But coming back to our chapter here in chapter 12, Jesus himself sees Mary's act not only as anticipating what's going to happen in the upper room, but as anticipating his burial, which gets described in chapter 19 of John. In chapter 19, there's a Sadducee by the name of Joseph who sees that Jesus gets placed in a garden tomb. Tomb that he won't use for very long, but does need for a couple of days. And a Pharisee by the name of Nicodemus also shows up in that chapter, making sure his body gets perfumed with lots of expensive spices, like the one that Mary poured out on him at this dinner party. And Jesus defends the extravagance of Mary against Judas's objections. He says that she saved this perfume for the day of his burial, but she's about 6 or 7 days too early here. She couldn't wait for Jesus to be buried, I guess. And Jesus seizes the opportunity to teach them and us an important truth about his unique death. You see, every generation of us will experience systems that oppress the poor, like they did in that day. We do well to care for the poor in every generation, but what ultimately redeems is not our care for the poor, as important as that is. What ultimately redeems in every generation is the kind of faith that Mary proclaims by her act, the faith that says, Christ has died, Christ is risen, and Christ will come again. Mary's deed doesn't go unnoticed, nor does the fact that Jesus is attending a dinner party with a once dead Lazarus. The hot gossip spreads from Bethany, and people from Jerusalem who are beginning to swell into the city for the Passover begin to spill over into Bethany too to check things out. Many of them begin to believe that Jesus is the Messiah. And this aggravates the anxiety of the religious leaders in Jerusalem even more. They plot to kill Lazarus too, and I speculate a little bit about Lazarus last week. Maybe they did succeed in killing him. That's what the movie Last Temptation of Christ suggested, at least. But we really don't know what happened to Lazarus. We only know that the authorities are getting pretty upset, and that the fame of this incident is ginning up the crowd for the famed incident that all four Gospels record that we celebrate today as Palm Sunday, that's described beginning in verse 12 of chapter 12. The next day, the great crowd that had come for the festival heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, Hosanna! Blessed is the one that comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel. Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, as it is written, Do not be afraid, daughter of Zion. See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt. At first, his disciples did not understand all this. Only after Jesus was glorified did they realize that these things had been written about him, and that these things had been done to him. Now the crowd that was with them when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to spread the word. Many people, because they had heard that he had performed this sign, went out to meet him. So they were part of that Palm Sunday crowd. So the Pharisees said to one another, See, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone after him. Now, if you know your Jewish holidays really, really well, you might recognize that there's some confusion here. What would you think if I were to mix Easter eggs with Santa Claus, or say that turkey is about Valentine's Day? What I mean is this. Many are beginning to believe that Jesus is the Messiah here. But this is Passover season. This is the oldest Jewish holiday that goes all the way back to when Moses delivered the people from Egypt by God's powerful hand, right? This is a holiday that by this time was well over 1,000 years old. But what they're celebrating here looks a lot more like what was probably the newest Jewish holiday, Hanukkah. It was only a 200-year-old holiday. It had taken place when a priest by the name of Judas Maccabeus had liberated Jerusalem from the Syrians, the Seleucid Empire. They were really sort of Greeks, but they were ruling from Syria. And he had purified the temple and restored worship there after the Seleucids had defiled it. And they had proclaimed him in a similar way coming into Jerusalem as a messianic figure and had cried hosannas, waving palm branches and so forth. And so this is Passover season, but they're celebrating a military victory in a religious purgation that has taken place. The crowd, including the disciples of Jesus here, undoubtedly thought something similar was going to happen with their hero, Jesus. But they learned to look at it from a different perspective. Because the fourth gospel, John's gospel, is going to show us that Jesus really ascends his throne when he's lifted up on a cross. The growing crowd here lifted him up on a donkey. They probably would have gladly lifted him up on their shoulders and carried him as a great victor. The priests recognize that an international incident is beginning to brew here as people from every nation have arrived in the city. And some of them were about to learn who witnessed this great Palm Sunday event want a very personal audience with Jesus. Look at verse 20. Now there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the festival. These aren't just Jews who've adopted Greek culture, but these are actual Gentiles, Greeks. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. Sir, they said, we would like to see Jesus. Philip went to tell Andrew. Andrew and Philip in turn told Jesus. And Jesus replied, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant will also be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and will glorify it again. The crowd that was there and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said an angel had spoken to him. Jesus said, this voice was for your benefit, not mine. Now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show the kind of death he was going to die. The crowd spoke up, "We have heard from the law that Messiah will remain forever. So how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" Then Jesus told them, "You are going to have the light just a little while longer. Walk while you have the light before darkness overtakes you. Whoever walks in the darkness does not know where they are going. Believe in the light while you have the light, so that you may become children of the light." And when he had finished speaking, Jesus left and hid himself from them. So at the beginning of this chapter, these Greeks understandably seek out a Jewish disciple who's got a good Greek name, Philip. He'd grown up in Bethsaida, a fishing village on the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus did a lot of miracles, called some of his disciples, like Peter and his brother Andrew, and Philip. But it was a place where Jews and Greeks freely mingled together. They lived in the same neighborhoods together. And it's a place, of course, where Jesus called some of these fishermen to leave their nets. So Philip goes and gets his fishing buddy Andrew to go with him and to ask this favor of Jesus that these Greeks bring to them. "Sir, we would see Jesus." That's a line you may have seen emblazoned on a pulpit somewhere. "Sir, we would see Jesus. By the way, you would honor me if you would evaluate my sermons by whether they proclaim Jesus Christ or not." But Jesus seems a bit aloof to the whole thing of them seeing him, because he envisions a kingship where he rules by sacrificial love, and he wants to reveal that to them before he opens himself up to this international following that is to follow. You see, there's been whole crowds that have stood in awe of Jesus from a distance, proclaiming him as he goes down the streets toward Jerusalem with hosannas. But so far, only Mary has come close enough to catch a scent of what it really means to see Jesus. She immediately covers up the scent of his death with expensive perfume. The way Jesus will get glory will come through sacrificing his love, his life as an act of love. A self-sacrificing love that not only takes up the basin and the towel as a servant, but also gets buried like a seed in the ground and dies to produce fruit. Jesus comes to bring abundant life, but to do so, he must lay down his life for his sheep. The hard news for Philip, Andrew, and the Greeks who happened to hear, as well as for us, is that to get everlasting life, we have to die too. You have to hate your life, which doesn't mean despising it, but handing over our values as of a being of little worth compared to the life that Jesus wants to give. And of course, we fight this death. And sometimes Christians get this idea wrong. Sometimes we get the idea that Jesus is calling us on some sort of suicidal course in pursuit of martyrdom. That was the problem of the early church. But the problem for us, even as we recognize that Jesus already in our readings today has sometimes gotten himself out of harm's way on more than one occasion, the problem for us is that maybe we understand too little of what it means to surrender our lives to God as Jesus surrendered himself on the cross. For starters, we need to surrender our earthly ideas of glory, couched as they were for these first Jewish audiences in wealth, in military power and nationalism. To give up those things can feel a lot like death. But because Jesus brushed aside earthly power and surrendered himself to God, submitted himself to Roman crucifixion, God has given him the reputation that exceeds all others, lifted him up to the ultimate place of rule over a heavenly kingdom that has never stopped growing. A few years ago, I spoke up here on the parable of the sower, and many of you came up on this platform with a handful of popcorn seeds, and we'd spread some dirt out on this beautiful wood platform. Do you remember that, some of you? Might have seemed like a waste of some perfectly good popcorn kernels. I mean, those popcorn seeds could have been popped into potential snacks that we all could have enjoyed. But an interesting thing happened. That mix of soil and popcorn seeds got dumped out in the yard of George and Wendy Klein. And when the time came and it was right, all kinds of living green sprouts came up from those dead seeds, just like Jesus talks about here. That's how God's kingdom grows. We cast ourselves at the feet of Jesus as Mary did. We pour out ourselves and become undone like her hair. We pour ourselves out like her ointment. And we receive power as the Holy Spirit brings to us a life that witnesses to the truth of Christ's death and of Christ's resurrection. A death and resurrection that took place for us and for our salvation. Next Sunday, we're going to celebrate some baptisms that picture this death and resurrection with Christ. It's like Jesus is saying to the Greeks, you want to see me? No audience now, but you show up on Good Friday and see me hanging on a cross. Then you'll see what I'm really about. Come prepared to die and to rise with me to newness of life. You want to serve me? You need to follow me to where I am, and my Father will honor you with new life. We've seen in our reading this morning that the Sanhedrin, the Jewish religious Supreme Court, had no desire to serve Jesus. They unintentionally did serve him by plotting his demise, but that wasn't their desire. Judas wants to serve Jesus, but he wants to serve Jesus for his own selfish ends. He has no stomach for this business of death and burial. Other believers in the crowds clamor to see Jesus, but they have little understanding of what following him would mean. They won't see it until after Jesus is glorified, after he's raised from the dead and ascends to heaven. In our readings this morning, it's Mary who stands as the model disciple, who has at least a little bit of understanding of his death, and who pours out her life as Jesus poured out his. And God has honored her for it, and God honors Jesus too. Jesus didn't find the path to the cross easy, but it proved essential for God's purpose for his life. And the same holds true for us. We heap praise on the Father's reputation when we surrender to his course for our lives, which begins when we trust Jesus. But you don't need to take my word for it. In fact, you don't even have to take the word of Jesus for it, because the Father himself in our passage this morning thundered this word from heaven. God will get his glory. The Father got glory through Jesus in the resurrection of Lazarus. The Father got glory through Jesus in the crowds that proclaimed his kingship on Palm Sunday. The Father got glory again through the resurrection of Jesus. And God will get glory through your resurrection and mine. But first, we must follow Jesus to the cross. And then God will get glory when we receive the crown. On the first Palm Sunday, the crowd didn't see much further than their own condemning spirit toward Rome. They didn't hope much further than driving out Governor Pilate and his legions. Today, we can see Jesus lifted up to death on the cross to expose and judge a much more profound evil, the evil of this world We can see Jesus drive out a much more profound adversary, the one called here the prince of the world, while at the same time reconciling people to God. That's what it really means to see Jesus. If you want to see Jesus, see him in his victory over death and sin and the devil. Through his own death as the sacrificial Lamb of God who takes away the world's sin, disempowering worldly authority. The death that Sanhedrin hoped would squelch the crowds keeps building the crowds even to our day. We even have a little crowd here this morning. But if you want to embrace it, you have to get used to the scent of death. You have to give the crowd credit for seeing that Jesus was talking about the D words, death and darkness. Even though they objected to them, they understood what Jesus was talking about. And so in these few days before Jesus is about to die, he encourages the crowd to build their faith by walking in the light of what they know about Jesus. When darkness covers the earth on the afternoon on Jesus' death, it will be nearly impossible for his closest friends even to believe in him. But if we grasp hold of the light while the light shines, we may serve as a light to others in a dark place. It isn't too much to say that Jesus wants to show his light through his body, his people on earth, including us. Have you ever heard that saying? Don't doubt in the dark what you saw in the light. That's what Jesus is talking about here for those who are about to enter the darkness of his cross. The irony of this story is that after these Greeks say, "We want to see Jesus," Jesus goes and hides himself. He does this to grow their faith, and that's what God does with us too. He wants to refocus our attention from his incredible signs in his life, which are important for building our faith, to his self-sacrifice and death. Do you want to see Jesus? Look at his cross, Jesus is saying. You think about that. Amen.